is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150 plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
We talk about career development. We talk about how do you navigate the coaching profession. And we focus on putting people in a position to create genuine relationships through our events.
Adam Gordon is the co-founder and CEO of Rising Coaches, a membership-based community for coaches that connects, develops, and facilitates career advancement for its members. Gordon previously spent 16 years working in college basketball, serving in various roles at the high major D1, D2, and JUCO levels. In 2019, Adam stepped away from coaching to put all his focus on building Rising Coaches. Gordon was an assistant and associate head coach at Southeast Missouri from 2015 to 2019. Before joining Southeast Missouri, he worked for 3 years as director of operations on Rick Ray's staff at Mississippi State. Gordon was in charge of travel, camps, scheduling, on-campus recruiting, and academic compliance during his stint with the Bulldogs. A native of Los Angeles, California, Gordon also spent time at Northern Colorado and was a graduate assistant at Clemson for 3 years. A 2006 graduate of Tampa who studied youth development and leadership at Clemson, Gordon was an assistant coach at Central Florida Community College in Ocala, Florida from 2006 to 2008 before going to Clemson. Prior to Central Florida Community College, Gordon was head manager and student assistant at the University of Tampa from 2002 to 2006. Hoopheads Nation, if you love what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to the show. Believe it or not, those ratings help others in the basketball community find the Hoopheads pod. We would also appreciate you sharing the show with one friend or coaching colleague that you know would enjoy listening to the Hoopheads podcast. And if you're not subscribed yet, just hit the subscribe button in your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. You can find the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, and YouTube. Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Adam Gordon from Rising Coaches. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, who is tending to his newborn daughter, Elizabeth. So Jason, we miss you on this one, but we are pleased to be joined tonight by Adam Gordon from Rising Coaches. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for having me. What an intro. That was big time.
Well, we're excited to have you on. I think that what you're doing with Rising Coaches is something that is right up the alley of all of our audience members out there. I think they're going to want to hear, those of you who maybe aren't aware of your organization and what you guys do for coaches and for the coaching profession, are going to definitely want to hear that. And we want to be able to dig into your backstory and learn a little bit more about your basketball journey and how you got to where you are today. So let's start that by going back in time to when you were a kid and talk a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball when you were younger.
I just always loved it. It wasn't passed down from a family member or anything like that. I guess I just kind of found the game, and you know, my earliest memories would be like Saturday mornings. You know, most kids would be up watching cartoons. My Saturdays, I'd get up and I'd turn on TV and watch NBA games. I'd start with like the East Coast games and watch the Knicks or whoever was on, and sit in front of the TV and watch 3-4 NBA games, go outside in the driveway and shoot for several hours, and then come back in and do it again. So just always loved it. And I think by about the time I was probably about 14 or 15, I was pretty set that I knew that I wanted to coach. Obviously, I played, and so I wanted to play, but I knew that when I was done playing, I wanted to get into coaching, and I knew that was my passion, you know, the career that I wanted to pursue.
All right, so two things there. One, as a player, what was it when you were young? What was it about the game of basketball that attracted you to it? Do you remember what part of it? Was it just the ability to go out and shoot on your driveway? Was it wanting to emulate the guys that you were watching on TV? What was it about the game that really drew you in and made basketball be the thing that you wanted to focus on?
You know, it was probably, I love football as well. And I, you know, when I was younger, I kind of went back and forth, you know, between what I wanted to do. Did I want to be a basketball coach, football coach? And probably the ability to go out by yourself in the driveway and play basketball for hours without needing anyone else or anything else is probably what kind of tipped the scale towards hoops.
Yeah, I think that's a common story for anybody who grows up with the game of basketball. I think that solitary time by yourself, whether it's in your own driveway, whether it's going into a gym, or back in the day being able to get up to a playground and get shots up, I think that's something that universally makes the game of basketball unique and popular with people, is that you can go out and practice it and get better on your own, which is something that you can't do obviously with football. It's much more challenging unless you want to just be in the weight room pumping iron all day. It's hard to get together and really work on your football skills in the same way. So talk a little bit about, from a playing standpoint, give me a memory or two that you remember from your playing career as a high school player, and just something that stands out to you when you think back about your time as a basketball player.
Oh, I mean, well, first of all, I wasn't that good. So
hey, you got to have some memory though. You got to have something. Oh, for sure. You got to have something that you can hang your hat on.
For sure. For sure. I mean, you know, I just remember all the hours I spent in the gym, you know, especially like as I got into my teenage years and, you know, going, I grew up like walking distance from like a rec center. And so I would be there every day shooting. And anyone that came into the gym, I'd like ask them what they wanted to play. And, you know, anyone, you know, whether it's an old man or like a young kid, I'd be playing whoever would do it. And then even like, you know, when I got a little older and could drive, I'd go to like the 24-hour fitness and be shooting in there till like 2 a.m. It was just kind of what I loved. Those are the memories that I think about. But yeah, I mean, like what do you want, a specific like game memory or something?
Yeah, or just something, maybe something with something with a teammate, something in the locker room, a funny story, just something that sticks out to you when you think back about the time when you were playing, and somebody says, "Hey, give me a story. Just give me something that kind of encapsulates what you remember about your playing days as a high school player."
Yeah, for sure. So I went to a school called Viewpoint School, which is a private school in Southern California, just outside of Los Angeles, and they're actually really, really good now. JJ Prince does a hell of a job coaching that team. But when I went there, we were terrible. And, you know, probably the thing that I remember the most and I'm most proud of is like my senior year, we just snuck into the playoffs for the first time in a long, long time. So we still weren't great, but we won just enough games to sneak in. And it came down to the last two games of the season. And this is crazy. So we played... I'm sure you've heard of Catalina. Like, have you seen the movie Step Brothers?
Yes, absolutely.
So you know the Catalina wine mixer, right?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So Catalina is a real place. It's an island, and you have to take like a boat to get there. And they were in our league, and so because it's an island, like you would play them back to back. So every other year, you'd either play at home and play like back to back games, like two consecutive nights.
Right.
Or you would go there, you know, and you do it over a weekend or whatever, and it kind of be a cool little weekend trip. So our senior year, our last game was at Avalon, was the school. So it was at Avalon, and we had to win both to clinch our playoff spot. So I want to make sure I get the order right. Yeah, like the first night, it was a really close game, and I knocked down the free throws to clinch it. Nice. So that was a big deal. You know, I think we were up like 2 or 1, and they had to foul. And I went to the line, knocked them both down, and kind of sealed the game there. And then the next night, which was like, you know, one more game left in the season, have to win this one to clinch the spot. I got loose in the second half and knocked down a couple back-to-back threes. And it was like in the middle, like it was a close game again. And there was probably like, I don't know, 6 minutes to go. And we went on like a run to break it open to like a double-digit lead. And in that run, I hit a couple back-to-back threes. And, you know, so that was the thing that I was most proud of and happy to, you know, contribute to or whatever. But it wasn't like I had this illustrious career and, you know, hoisting state championships. But it was cool. It was cool to be a part of it, and especially to see where Viewpoint is now. I mean, they got a dude in the league. They got several Division I players. They're a legit program. So I was happy to. You know, I don't know. I don't know that I was the foundation or part of the foundation, but I was happy to be a tiny part of their history.
There you go. Well, hey, do you still have teammates that you keep in contact with from your high school career? Anybody that you're still in touch with?
Yeah, for sure. I'm still close with a lot of guys that I went to high school with. So
that's awesome.
Every time I get back to Southern California, which is not as often as I'd like, we try to link up and hang out.
Very cool. I think that's one of the best parts of when you think about the memories. And of course, you remember the games and big baskets and victories and that kind of thing. And I know, at least for me too, the losses tend to stick with me pretty well too. But I think that the most important thing is you remember that time in the locker room, you remember the time with your teammates. And I think that's something that, as a coach, it's important to remember how important those memories are to the players that you're coaching. Because I think those are some of the things that we always tend to remember as we get older. So let me ask you, you mentioned that by the time you were 15 or 16 that you had in your mind that you wanted to coach. How did you come to that realization that coaching was going to be something that was going to be part of your future at that young of an age? It's interesting because we usually, I don't know if you found this in the coaches that you talk to and the coaches that you've been able to interact with over time, but I find that most coaches come in one of two camps. Either there's somebody who, from a surprisingly young age, have an idea that they want to coach, or there's somebody who is a player and they're focused on playing, and then all of a sudden their playing career gets done and then they look around and say, oh, maybe I'm going to coach now. And so I always find it interesting to hear both sides of the story. So give me the idea of why coaching was so attractive to you at that young of an age.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why necessarily. I think it goes back. I just watch so much like professional sports on TV, and you know, they do a good job in the NBA and the NFL of like highlighting the coaches and telling their stories. And I would watch every, you know, coaching documentary that was on, you know, like back then there wasn't like 30 for 30 or anything, but like NFL Films would do their deal with the narrator with the super deep voice. And
right, yep.
That would always get me jacked up. And, you know, I was a big like Phil Jackson fan and read his books and would read like the John Wooden books and stuff like that. So I don't know what it was about it. I just know that, you know, it was pretty early on that I knew that that's the direction I wanted to go.
All right. So you get done with high school. How does a California kid end up at the University of Tampa?
Yeah, I feel like I tell this story all the time, but basically I wanted to try to walk on and play. And I knew I wasn't good enough for Division I. I was clueless, Mike. Like, I didn't know anything about college basketball. So I thought, like, oh, Division II, like, I'll be able to do that.
Right.
And I was like, in case it doesn't work out, just in case, I want to be at a really, really good program so that at least I'm, you know, I can be a manager and be a part of a winning tradition. So, you know, I looked at the top 10 Division IIs my senior year of high school, thinking like, oh, you know, I could do that, not knowing that like any of those top 10 could beat, you know, several Division I's on any given night.
Isn't it amazing? I don't mean to interrupt you, but it's amazing to me when you think about the fact that you as a high school player back in the early 2000s didn't have the same type of information at your fingertips that players, parents, coaches. And again, not that all the information that people have today is always the best information or accurate information, but there certainly is information available. And I had a similar story in that I ended up getting an opportunity to play Division I basketball, but going into my senior year, I was being recruited by Kent State, which is where I ultimately ended up going. And they called me up and asked me to come down for an official visit. And I declined the official visit. I said, nah, I'll come down, but I don't want to take an official visit, because at that point, my high school coach had no experience with anybody being recruited. I had no idea what I was doing. My parents didn't have any idea. There was no internet at the time for people to go and try to find information. So I still thought at that point that Duke was going to be calling, North Carolina was going to be calling, Ohio State was going to be calling. And so I said, nah, I don't want to take an official visit. And you look back on that, and that really turned them off, and they pretty much stopped recruiting me. And then I had to re-recruit myself come the spring of my senior year in order to be able to get an opportunity to go and play. And I think, to your point, there was such a lack of information if you go back to the time, you know, sort of pre-internet. And if you didn't have somebody in your network that knew sort of the ins and outs of what could be expected as, you know, when you're being recruited, you know, you could end up with pretty unrealistic expectations of what you think that process was going to be like.
Oh, well, and then you got to be like humble enough and smart enough, even if you do have that information, to not be like hard-headed and actually listen to that advice. Because I went to one of the Branch West like exposure camps, which was run by Bob Gottlieb, legend, you know, father of Doug Gottlieb and Greg Gottlieb. But anyways, you know, he knows what he's talking about, and he told me right away, he's like, you need to find a Division III, like you can play at that level and find one that, you know, you want to go to school at and you can have a nice, you know, career. And I was like, oh, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. So you got to be like smart enough and humble enough to, even if you do have that information, to heed the warning.
So true. And so many of us at age 17 and 18, we all have that, right? We all are very humble at that age.
Oh, 17, 18, 20, 25, 30. I mean, it's amazing how many times in my life that I look back at it and I'm like, man, why didn't I just, like, you know, see the signs and listen to the good advice that I've got?
No question. No question. So that being said, you do end up at the University of Tampa. So talk about how you got there.
Yeah. So like I said, I was looking at the top 10 D2s in the country at that time. And it was like all these freezing cold Midwest schools, Minnesota, Mankato, South Dakota State was D2 at that time and really good. North Dakota, I think, was D2 at that time, really getting in it. So I saw all these schools. I was like, I don't know about that. And then I saw University of Tampa. I was like, well, that one sounds good.
That sounds good. So, like that weather.
Yeah. So I started like researching the school, and I reached out to their head coach and did a lot of homework on him. And it was Coach Richard Schmidt, who's actually still there. He's been there since he started the program in 81. Before that, he was the head coach at Vanderbilt in the 70s, and he was an assistant at Virginia when they were really, really good in the 70s. So, you know, a coaching legend. And Coach Schmidt was like, yeah, come on, you can walk on, like, no problem. And then I get there, and like, you know, 2 months in, he's like, no, you can't play for us. I was like, what the? Like, I came here for this reason.
Right.
He's like, well, you could be a manager. So I jumped at that opportunity, and it was the best thing I've ever done. I got so much experience and, you know, the opportunity to get like hands-on experience at that Division II level where you don't have a big staff and you don't have a ton of resources. You know, I got to wear so many hats and just really jump into the deep end and start, you know, working at what I ultimately like was passionate about and wanted to do, which was coaching.
For sure. All right. So here's a question that I love to ask coaches who go from one day you're a player and then the next season, or in your case, the next minute, you go from being on one side of the coaching equation to the other side of the coaching equation. So when you became a manager, you kind of got behind the scenes, so to speak. What were one or two things, if you can remember back to that time, what were one or two things that stuck out to you that were surprising that maybe you didn't realize coaches did, or maybe you didn't realize they did as much of it? What was something that you weren't expecting that you ended up doing as a coach that you would have never thought of as a player?
Oh, good question. I don't know. I don't know that I have a good answer for that. We kind of had a different situation. It wasn't like a great look into like the coaching lifestyle like it was at all my other stops. And I say that because Coach Schmidt, you know, we would practice at like 3 o'clock every day. And Coach Schmidt is a great, great coach. And I don't say this to like, you know, he's got his thing, his process, and it works. But he, you know, if we have 3 o'clock practice, he's showing up at 2, and he's out the door at 5:30. So he's not there. And then at the time, they had enough money for one full time assistant. And at the time, Coach Schmidt decided to split that salary into 2 part times. So our assistant coaches didn't show up. You know, they both taught. One of them taught. One of them worked at a health club.
Okay.
So neither one of them showed up till the afternoon. And so I was the only one around, like in the mornings.
You're answering phones, you're doing all the work, right?
I was, which That's was funny. Awesome. Like I loved it for somebody, you know, so eager to get into it. It was amazing. And, you know, to really be the only one around. Which sounds nuts saying now.
It's crazy. You're manning the whole entire basketball office by yourself. That's very interesting. And I'm sure, as you said, a very cool spot to be in, both A, from a standpoint of the things that you were able to learn that you had to do, I'm sure, at being in that situation. And then just kind of being, hey, I'm the guy here right now. I'm kind of in charge as I'm walking around. I'm the only coach on campus right now.
Yeah. Well, I certainly wasn't in charge.
Right.
But I acted like it.
Right. Exactly. Absolutely.
But I guess going back to your question, the thing that like it was just the thing that was surprising the most was like how naive I was and how much I didn't know about the game and how much I learned just being around Coach Schmidt and his staff, Lisa Beamer and Mark Olson, and just being around practice every, you know, like my knowledge of the game, it was like going through a crash course of basketball. And it really like looking back on it, it's like I knew nothing. Coming from like my playing career and high school career to college was like a whole new level.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. One of the things that I always find to be interesting, and this is, I guess, my perspective when I think back to my time as a player, both as a high school player and then as a college player, one of the things that I never really looked at in terms of a coaching professional track was being a manager. I never in my playing career once looked at a manager and thought, oh, that guy is in training to become a coach. I never really even thought of it that way. And it's amazing to me the number of guys that started out as managers that end up achieving a tremendous amount of success as coaches. And like I said, I never looked at that as a player. I never thought of it that way. And yet, I look back on it now and I'm like, gosh, how didn't I see that would have been a great track for anybody who wanted to get in coaching? Because again, you're behind that curtain. You're getting to see what those coaches do every single day. And in a lot of cases, you're getting to do at least something. Now, maybe you're not doing a whole lot of coaching on the floor if you're the manager at, you know, whatever program. Maybe you got a chance to do that a little bit more. But I think most managers don't necessarily get to coach on the floor. But as far as seeing and being able to observe and be a part of meetings and just seeing what goes on, I think it's got to be a tremendous training ground for young coaches.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And especially like at that small college level, I'd say you get so much more hands-on, you know, experience. But the flip side is you go be part of a big-time program. You know, like I think back, and I'm sure we'll get to it later, but I think back to my time at Clemson. And our managers there, so many of them have gone on to have successful coaching careers. And part of it, I think, is because you meet so many talented people being a part of a big staff like that. Maybe you don't get the hands-on experience, but you know, there's two parts of coaching, right? You got to be good at your craft. And then the other part is like, you have to have a network and you got to know a bunch of people who are going to help you in terms of relationships and whatnot. And so maybe you don't get as much of like working on your craft at a big program, but you certainly get a jump start on the networking piece.
Yeah, no question about that. And I think no matter what level you're at, whether it's, you know, at a Clemson or a Division I school, or you're at a smaller school, I think that this is one of the things that comes across loud and clear in our podcast with all the different people that we've been able to talk to at all different levels of the game, is you have great coaches coaching middle school basketball and you have great coaches coaching Division I basketball. And I think no matter where you are, if you're starting out your career, you can learn from anybody whose staff you are a part of. And I think that's something that is really important for young coaches out there to remember, is that make sure wherever you are that you're doing the best job that you possibly can and that you're paying attention to what the people who are part of your staff are doing so that you can learn from them. And sometimes you're going to learn the things that you want to do. And I'm sure you can attest to this, that there were things that you observed over the course of your coaching career that you're like, yeah, I'm going to make sure that I never do that because that doesn't work, or that doesn't work for me or my philosophy.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, I can only speak to my experience, but I'm so fortunate that I got to work for, you know, so many different coaches along the way and work in so many different programs and see different ways of doing things. Again, you know, there's no right or wrong way to do it, but, you know, I'm sure there's advantages to being in one place for a long time and, you know, really becoming ingrained in that system. But I loved the way it went down for me and all the different coaches and styles of play that I was able to be a part of.
So after you get done and you graduate from the University of Tampa, what is the plan from there? I know you ended up at the College of Central Florida, but what was the plan when you graduated? Tell me about the process for going out and finding that first job.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be like your story of not taking the visit to Kent State.
All right.
My plan was to go be the GA at Duke. And if I couldn't get that job, I was going to go be the GA at University of Florida.
All right. Well, that's a good plan.
Yeah, it was a great plan.
I like the plan.
Yeah, no question. So what happened was I went to the Final Four with Mark Olson, who was an assistant at Tampa at the time. And you know, we were walking down the street and Mark was great and treated me great and was trying to help, you know, help me find a job and a foot in the door. We were walking down the street in Atlanta, I believe, or maybe Indianapolis, I can't remember, and ran into Tim Ryan, the coach at College of Central Florida. And Mark and Tim knew each other, and they stopped and talked for a little bit like you do there at the Final Four. And, you know, Mark was like, hey, this is Adam. He's our manager. He's looking for a job. He's great. If you know of anything, let me know. And Tim was like, actually, I need an assistant. You know, if you really like him, let's talk. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. When we get back from the Final Four, we'll get you onto campus and let you check it out and come interview for the job. So my stubborn, naive self, dumb self gets done with that interaction. I'm like, you know, I don't know if JUCO's for me. I don't want to coach the JUCO level. I think I can get better than this. You know, this is a top 25, a perennial top 25 JUCO program in Florida, which is, you know, one of the top two or three JUCO leagues in the country. And it's the only assistant job. You know, there's only one assistant coach there. So you're the second guy. And so thank God Mark Olson was like, you know, you need to get your ass in the car and go up there and go on that job interview. And I did it, and I did it begrudgingly. And I showed up, and I, you know, like Tim Ryan, who's a Hall of Famer there, and he's still there. And it's great. They're actually disbanding the program after this season, which is crazy in a whole nother discussion. But Tim does such a good job and has that program so down to a science in terms of operations and support. And, you know, I went there thinking this was going to be a small time JUCO thing. And I left so sold by his operation and his vision and, you know, just his program and the way it worked. And, you know, I remember like driving away from Ocala being so excited about the opportunity. And so I took the job that day. And as soon as I graduated, I think it was like, you know, 3 or 4 days later, I packed up my car and moved out there.
That's very cool. So what were one or two things from that time that you learned that you still carry with you today in terms of a coaching philosophy or things that you learned there that you still believe in, that you still think are important?
Man, there's so many things that I learned and that I use to this day from Coach Ryan. I'll just give you two
sure.
that I like in terms of coaching. Number one, recruiting wise, Tim has an interesting background. Like Tim didn't get into coaching until later in life. And so he, I believe, sold either insurance or mortgages, or he was in like some sort of sales role.
Gotcha.
And his approach to recruiting was very similar to how he approached sales back in the day, which is like it's a numbers game. And his big thing was like, the best thing you can tell me is like, yes, I want to come. And the second best thing you can tell me is no. And so like he was so, you know, that first, I remember like our offices were connected so I could like hear every phone conversation that he would have with recruits. And like his first conversation with every recruit was always painting a picture of like how hard it was. And hey, this is not for everybody. And these are all of our expectations. And it's really probably not for you. And I'd be sitting there like, Coach, I've been spending months like trying to get this kid on the hook and you're trying to talk him out of it. But he just did such a good job of, you know, being crystal clear with the expectations. And so that there was no confusion and you knew exactly what you were walking into. And he had a lot of structure now and he didn't try to hide any of it. You know, the curfew, the mandatory breakfast, you know, all of those things. And the other part of it, which is crazy, is like kids would get off the phone and it'd be like, you know, as soon as you tell them this is probably not for you, they want to do it.
Right.
Which is nuts. But that's just how it works most of the time. So that's a big thing that I took with me into like, you know, my recruiting philosophy is trying to get to that stuff right away and then trying not to get caught up in that like, you know, in between area and string it out. We want to get to the good stuff as soon as possible.
Get to the truth right away.
Yeah, no question. And see if it's a fit, and if it's a fit, great. And if not, great. We'll move on. And wish you the best of luck. It was never personal. It was never emotional. You know, I've been around so many coaches who, and you know, it's hard not to because you put so much time in, and I've been guilty of this, but you know, so many of us get emotional when a recruit doesn't go our way. And it was never like that with him. It was just, you know, like, okay, no problem. Best of luck. We're on to the next one.
Gotcha.
So I love that. I love that approach. I guess the other thing, since you asked for two, is I love this. And maybe you can only do this at the JUCO level where you're basically starting over with a roster every year. And I don't know if he still does it or not, but like when I was there, every first practice, no matter what, the first practice of every season, he would, whoever showed up last, he would kick out of the gym instantly. So, you know, if practice starts at 3 o'clock and someone shows up at 2:45, you know, he'd be out there, he'd meet him at the door. What do you do? What do you think this is? High school? Like, you can't just show up 15 minutes before practice, get the heck out of here, go home, you know, try again tomorrow. And it would just set the tone. And it was, you know, it's the first practice. Who cares if someone misses one practice at the beginning of the year?
Right.
Now, I'm sure that kid's devastated. But it just, again, it sets the tone for everybody and lets them all know, like, this is serious business. And so I love that approach. And again, you know, I don't know if he still does it, but it was awesome when I was there. For me, now the players were probably sitting there looking at each other like, this guy's nuts. But, you know, sometimes you got to be like that to get, you know, the best out of people, especially, you know, when you're dealing with all freshmen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when you think about that and you think about it from a player perspective, you think about a coach perspective, you know, obviously there's two different viewpoints there, but I think it definitely, I could see where it gets players' attention and it accomplishes what he intended to accomplish, which is let's make sure that we're all taking this as seriously as we need to. And let's make sure that we're here early and we're ready to go and that we're going to get after it here at whenever you show up for a practice. So that's good stuff. Head Start Basketball, along with members of the Jay Billis Skills Camp staff, will be hosting the very first Prime Skills Camp, an affiliate of the Jay Billis Skills Camp that is held annually in Charlotte, North Carolina. Prime Skills Camp will take place on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, June 26th through the 28th, and will be designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9. Prime Skills Camp will mirror the Jay Billis Skills Camp in daily programming, teaching, coach-to-camper ratio, and quality of instruction. Prime Skills Camp brings all of the team-oriented individual instruction, focus on the fundamentals, and high-level coaching to young men aspiring to a high school varsity basketball experience. This camp is operated by Billis Camp veterans and includes the Jay Billis Coaches Development Program alongside the camp, ensuring that the quality of teaching and coaching at this camp is second to none. Please visit headstartbasketball.com or jbillescamp.com for more information or to get registered. How does the opportunity then come to pass after you are done at the College of Central Florida? How does the opportunity come for you to go and join the Division I staff, ACC, at Clemson?
So I guess it was after my second year, the GA spot at Clemson came open, and I didn't know it. I wasn't aware of it. It wasn't one of those things that got posted. But Tim Ryan was really close with one of their assistants, Josh Pastorino. They're both Clearwater, Florida guys, and knew each other from back in the day. And that's how I got it. Tim, it was 100% Tim Ryan hooking me up with Josh, who got me in the door, and then from there was able to, you know, fortunately get the job.
What was that interview process like? Do you remember?
I absolutely remember. It was with Oliver Purnell. Oliver is one of a kind. I love him. And he is notorious for having like weird, quirky things on his interviews. So mine is a favorite of several of the former Clemson staffers. But I showed up. I was in a suit. I didn't see Coach Purnell at all. I was going around with Mike Morrell, who was the ops guy at the time. He's now the head coach at UNC Asheville. And so Mike is touring me around on the golf cart. It's like 100 degrees outside. I'm sweating my balls off in my in my suit and tie. And I finally get in to the office, and it's probably like mid-afternoon. And Coach Purnell's walking out of the office, and he's like, "Oh, nice suit. Why don't you like change out of that, put on some shorts, and come over to my house this evening, and we'll hang out there." I was like, "Okay, great." So Mike takes me over to Coach's house, and we go down to his like basement, which is like his man cave. And he's hanging out there, probably drinking a couple cocktails or beers or whatever with like one of his boys and like several of the other like staff members. And they're sitting in there watching. They got Sports Center on, just hanging out. And Coach Purnell's like, "Hey, Adam, why don't you come outside with me on the patio? And we'll talk a little bit there." And I was like, "All right." So we go outside, and everyone's still in the basement or whatever. And we're out there in his backyard on the patio next to his pool. And he pulls up like two lawn chairs, and he's like, "I'll be right back. Have a seat." And I was like, "Okay." So I sit down. I'm like, "All right." You know, I'm kind of like adjusting, getting myself mentally ready, because I'm like, "All right, this is, we're about to have like the interview." And Coach comes back like 5 minutes later in a bathing suit, and he like dives into the pool and starts swimming laps. And I'm sitting there like watching him swim, like the most awkward thing, you know, ever. And he like, he like swims up to like this, the edge of the pool. And he's like, "So Adam, why should I hire you?" And I don't remember what I said, but I gave him some answer, and that was it. He's like, "Okay, sounds good. Let's all get on my boat and cruise around." So we got on, you know, that was literally it. That was the only like interview question.
And then that's amazing.
We all got on his boat. We sailed to like a dockside restaurant somewhere else. We ate there. We got back on the boat. I'm pretty sure he got lost on the way back. And then we eventually got back at like 11. And that was the entire interview. And he's notorious for like whoever he brings on campus, he's going to put them in a weird situation where you're just kind of hanging out with them and he's trying to get a feel for like what you're like in those settings.
Right.
So that was my deal. I got to watch him swim.
Did you know that going in? I mean, did you have an idea that weird things were going on? Had you been warned or was that completely catch you by surprise?
Warning. Yeah. No warning at all. Thanks, wow. Josh.
Yeah. That's gotta be a little disconcerting when you're sitting there, you gotta be going, oh man, what's going on here? Am I going to be getting this job? And this all seems a little bit odd. Did you end up then seeing that? Did anybody else get hired after you on the staff while you were there as a coach? Did you see anything else that he did in another interview that was similar?
I didn't see anything firsthand, but, you know, John Sanderson, who was our strength coach when I first got there, he's now at Michigan. He always talked about his interview story where he, you know, they both were like boaters. They both had a boat.
Okay.
And so Oliver was like talking to him about boats and, he basically took him. He's like, I need to get a part to like tow my boat and I don't know what to get. So he took him to like the store and made John pick out what he needed. And then they started towing his boat and they had to go up like, they had to go down a steep hill and then right up a steep hill to get to his house and they got stuck. So like Oliver got out and John had to like get in the driver's seat and drive Oliver's car and boat, like towing his boat around. So that's a pretty epic one as well. So
that's hilarious.
At least I'm glad I wasn't the only one.
That's good stuff. Everybody's got their quirks, right?
No doubt.
Everybody's got their quirks. All right. So talk to me a little bit about the difference between being a part of a Division I ACC program compared to a Division II or a JUCO program. What were some things that jumped out at you right away that you said, hey, this is different here? And then maybe what were some of the things that were the same?
Yeah, well, I felt super prepared, you know, having been at the D2 level, which we talked about, and then at the JUCO level where I was the only assistant and it was like, you're literally doing everything. I mean, JUCO is the best way to get your career started because you're going to do every scout. You're going to recruit every kid. You're going to tape ankles. You're going to be the strength coach. I mean, you got to do it all. So going to the ACC, you know, I was expecting it to be this like crazy next jump. And really I felt prepared for anything that they threw at me. But the biggest difference is like you go from being a part of a staff of two to now you're on a staff of eight, which was awesome. But that's, you know, that was the biggest difference. Like, you know, being able to work with other people and manage and juggle different personalities and different needs and whatnot. So that was the biggest, you know, adjustment was just being on a big staff like that.
From a competitive standpoint, from a player standpoint, what did you find, if any, to be the differences between the levels? Obviously, you have, I'm going to say, better players, more talented players at the Division I level that you do at the other two levels. But in terms of your actual coaching on the floor and in terms of what players are looking for, I'm guessing there probably wasn't much difference in what the guys at Clemson were looking for compared to what the guys at your previous two stops have been looking for. They're looking for somebody who's going to help them get better and knows what they're talking about. And as long as you're doing those two things, I'm guessing you're going to have success no matter where you are.
Yeah, I would say that's pretty accurate. Yeah, I mean, I think players just want to know that their staff cares about them and is willing to give their time to them to help them, you know, achieve their goals. So I would say, you know, probably pretty similar. But again, you know, that big staff helps, you know, make you feel it helps make you feel more supported and more important. And obviously the resources and everything that you have at your fingertips at that level is a really, really nice, you know, luxury and bonus.
Do you have a game or a memory from your time there that stands out?
Man, so many memories. Beating Duke by 27 was a big one. Beating North Carolina by 24 was a big one. Coming back from down 17 at half at Virginia Tech Actually, a loss. We played Wake Forest. This is probably 2010, maybe. And we were maybe 15-0. And I think they were like 16-0. I think we were the two last undefeated teams in the country. And this is when they had Jeff Teague. They had, I think Ish Smith was a freshman. They had James Johnson. I'm forgetting one other stud that they had. Oh, Al Farouk Aminu was on that team. And it was an awesome, awesome atmosphere. I remember we ended up, like I said, we lost that game. It was a close game throughout. I think we had been down like 8 and maybe at the under 4 or under 8 media in the second half. We had just went on a run to tie it. And Trevor Booker, who was on our team, who had a long NBA career, he went up for a dunk. We, you know, we pressed 40 minutes a game and we got a steal. DeMontez Stitt, who actually passed away several years ago of a freak accident. But anyways, he got a steal at half court, threw it ahead to Trevor, who like jumped up and tomahawk dunked it, but he missed it, but he got fouled. But the ball went off the back of the rim and flew like all the way back beyond half court. It was like the best missed dunk I'd ever seen. And it took us into the media and it gave us a chance to, I think, take the lead. I think we were down one and he was going to the line with two free throws. And I swear to God, the Little John Coliseum was shaking. It was so loud in there. That was an awesome memory. So a lot of great times, and obviously super fortunate to be a part of three straight NCAA tournaments, two with Coach Purnell and then one under Brad Brownell's staff.
I think to be able to play in those kinds of environments, or to coach in those kind of environments where you have the crowds, I'm sure that that was something that you really enjoyed when you get to play in those kinds of environments, whether it's your home environment where people are going crazy when you're winning, or conversely, when you're going into a hostile environment. To be honest, I always enjoyed going and playing in a hostile environment and coaching in a hostile environment and being able to quiet those crowds when you get an opportunity to do that. I always found that to be one of the most satisfying sounds in the game of basketball, is when you or your team are able to go on a run and quiet that big crowd. So I'm sure you got an opportunity to do that while you were there at Clemson, with all the ACC and everything that goes along with that Division I experience. After Clemson, your next two jobs are director of operations. So for maybe a high school coach or somebody who's not as familiar with the workings of a college staff, just give us an idea of what the responsibilities are of a director of operations.
Yeah, so I was the ops guy at Northern Colorado, and I was the ops guy at Mississippi State. And those are two completely different job descriptions.
Okay.
Being a low major ops guy and a high major ops guy. You know, at Northern Colorado, you know, if you're the ops guy and the light bulb goes out in the locker room, you're going to go get a ladder. You're going to figure out where the light bulbs are. You can go up the ladder and you're going to change it. You know, at Mississippi State, you got a big staff underneath you that you're managing, and you're in meetings with, you know, this was the coolest part of the job, but you're in meetings, you know, monthly with like senior counsel and the athletic director and the head coaches of all the revenue generating sports. And you're talking about like high level stuff, and you're there representing the basketball program. So it's completely different, but, regardless, you're in charge of, in both situations, you know, you're in charge of the team's day-to-day life. And you're also probably the liaison between like the basketball program and the university and the basketball program and the community. So those are like huge, important, tasks. There's a lot of busy work and menial tasks that go along with it. But I always say, like, being an ops guy probably is the closest thing to getting someone ready to actually running a program, because you're having to take a step outside of the X's and O's and all the issues that consume you on the court and basketball wise, and actually think about, like, how do we run this program? how does our communication, you know, work? What is that workflow like? What are the different communication channels? Who needs to know about things? Who doesn't? You know, what is the best course of action on road trips and travel and scheduling? And should we practice at this time? How does that affect everything else? You know, you're really having to look big picture and look long term, which is a great exercise for anybody who wants to eventually run a program.
Absolutely. So this question is going to kind of jump ahead a little bit, but in your role now with Rising Coaches, when you start talking to young coaches who are eventually looking to, whether it's coach in high school or become a college head coach or whatever the case might be, I would guess that most of them, probably if you asked them at the beginning of their career, would probably say they had a better handle on the game itself, the coaching on the floor, the X's and O's, than they do of the things that you just described, which is kind of the day-to-day mechanics of how to get to put together a program. So when you're talking to young coaches, you're trying to help them in their careers, I would guess that you spend a lot of time talking to them about the program building side, the operation side of it, as much as you do the X's and O's side.
Yeah, I mean, it's super important. I mean, it is the other side of the job. You got to be able to coach, but you also have to be able to run a program. You know, I know we just talked about him, but Oliver Purnell was the best at that. I mean, he was such a CEO of Clemson basketball, which was great, and that worked for him. And that's not the only way to do it. Brad Brownell, on the flip side, who came in right after him, is the ultimate X's and O's coach. And they, not to say like one wasn't good at the other and the other, you know, like they both were the full package, but you know, that's what their strengths were.
Understood.
And they're both equally important.
So I'm guessing then that you have to have a little bit of self-awareness as a head coach to understand where your strengths and weaknesses lie, to make sure that when you're building out your staff, especially when you're talking about the Division I level, where you have more assistants, that you're building out your staff with people who complement you and fill in maybe some of the areas that either you're A, weak at, or B, maybe don't want to spend as much time on, then you want to get the right people in place. They're going to make sure that you are able to cover the entire gamut of what the program needs.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, self-awareness is the key. It all starts with that. And it starts with, you know, having a vision and really knowing what you want to be good at. You can't be good at everything. You just can't. That's in basketball. I just recently discovered that that's in business as well. Running Rising Coach.
Understood.
Yeah. So you really have to, you know, subtract and figure out, okay, what areas do we want to be great in? And then you can start building everything from that. You know, what do we want to be great at? What am I great at? Okay, fill in the blanks.
All right, so let's go from the director of ops to your last stop on your coaching career before you go full-time with Rising Coaches, and we'll get back to the genesis of how that got started, because I know it started along the process while you're at Clemson, but we'll jump backwards after we touch on your last stop. So you finish at Southeast Missouri State. Talk a little bit about your role there, what you did, and then ultimately why you decided to step away to focus on Rising Coaches full time. And then we'll jump back to how you got the whole thing started.
Yeah, for sure. So I'll just give you a quick background. Rick Ray was on Brad Brownell's staff at Clemson. He was the associate head coach there my last year at Clemson. I left after my GA ended, and I went to go be the ops guy at Northern Colorado. And then Rick got the Mississippi State job. And so as soon as he got that, you know, I went with him as the ops guy. Rick only stayed there for 3 years before we were let go. And that's a whole nother podcast, but it sucked for him. It ended up being great for me because I got to go from being an ops to an assistant because he ended up taking the Southeast Missouri State job. So I went with him to SEMO. And became the assistant coach. And I was there. Yeah, I was there for 4 years and eventually got promoted to associate head coach and, you know, had a lot of fun and loved every second of it and had ups and downs like everybody and learned a ton.
So did you, when you started Rising Coaches, let's go back. Give us the story of how that started, and then I'll ask my follow-up question, which is, at what point did you start to say, this is the direction that I'm starting to feel my calling, and it may be time for me to step away from the day-to-day grind of coaching? So talk about how you got started, and then maybe answer the question of why you decided to take it full-time, and then we can dive into all the things that you're doing there.
Okay, sure. So yeah, when I was at Clemson, this is, you know, probably my, I guess it was our, my second year there. I shared an office, and one of my best friends, Andy Farrell, he was our video coordinator there. He's now at Dayton, who they're crushing it right now.
Absolutely.
And Trey Meyer, who is an assistant coach at Presbyterian, was one of our managers, and he was a senior there at that time. And he was, you know, it was very clear that he was going to go into coaching. And so we were all sitting there, you know, young, single guys, just trying to get started in the coaching profession. And, you know, we just wanted to connect with other, you know, we understood it's a relationship business, and we wanted to connect with other people who were trying to do the same thing that we were trying to do. Andy and I were fortunate enough to go to the EXOS user conference, which EXOS was our video editing software at the time. And so they flew us out to Vegas to learn, I'm doing air quotes here, but to learn how to use the software.
Okay, gotcha.
So, but really we're out in Vegas with like 20 other coaches, and it's just, you know, there was some like workshop sessions on the software, and they had some, you know, very, very technical stuff that they talked about. But it was a tremendous weekend because we got to hang out in Vegas with 20 other coaches, and we left like really close with those guys. And, you know, Andy and I just kind of looked at each other and were like, you know, this would be great for, you know, we could do something like this, but instead of talking about, you know, video editing, you know, we could talk about basketball and how to navigate the coaching profession. But the biggest thing is like that relationship piece of being in Vegas for 2-3 days with, you know, a handful of other coaches and the relationships that come from that. And so that's literally how it started. And we, Andy left with Oliver Purnell to DePaul, and I was kind of in flux. I didn't know if I was going to be part of Brad Brownell's staff or not. I was just kind of the GA that was kind of hanging out in the office still. and we were just like, all right, now's the time. Let's, you know, we'd kind of been toying with the idea for a little while. And, you know, it was like, this is the time to do it. Let's go. And that's really how it started. And we put it, you know, we started it the day before the recruiting period started with all the Vegas tournaments. And so the basketball world was out in Vegas anyways. And we thought we'd piggyback off of that. And I think that first year we had 32 coaches there. And it's crazy to see, you know, I'm still in touch with pretty much all of them. It's crazy to see where those guys are at now in their career. And then each year just kind of grew and grew and got bigger, and we added events and that's kind of how it started.
So that first year, what did that event look like? What did you guys do that first year as you were putting it together?
Yeah. So we got coaches who were out there recruiting, and we asked them to come speak.
Okay.
And you know, our initial thought process was like, okay, we don't need to get these big name coaches. We'll just get, you know, like up and coming assistant coaches, because that's what we were all support staff guys. And that was the position that we wanted. So let's hear from a bunch of like, surely we'll be able to get assistance.
Right.
But we were blown away. Like we actually were able to get like an unbelievable lineup, even that first year. I'm trying to think back, you know, Brad Brownell spoke, Steve Lavin spoke, Buzz Williams spoke, Kevin O'Neill, who was the head coach at SC at the time, spoke. You know, the list goes on and on. And over the years, we've been blown away by, you know, like how giving the coaching community has been, and how many great Hall of Fame coaches have come and, you know, given up their time to come speak to our group. But yeah, that was it. It's, you know, the first night is you get there and there's like a little meet and greet at a bar. And obviously we're in Vegas at this time.
and, you know, in a casino bar. And so there's a lot going on, and we just hang out and everyone gets to know each other. And then the next day is like basically 9 to 5. You're in a conference room listening to speakers. And, you know, we were able to raise some money through different sponsors to pay for everyone's meals and do that up really nice. And after that day ended, we took everyone out to a really nice dinner. And then we did the last day is like a morning session of like 9 to noon of speakers. And then we roll out. So that was the first event.
So two things that struck me from what you said. Number one, I can attest to the same thing you talked about in terms of the willingness of people in the basketball community, coaches and otherwise, to share their time, to share their knowledge with other people. The podcast is like a living example of that. If you would have told me back when we started this thing in 2018 that we'd have been able to have the guest list that we've been able to have, I would have probably told you were crazy. But just the amount of people that have been, A, willing to come on themselves. And then what I found, Adam, to be especially gratifying to me is that after someone comes on, then inevitably I'll get an email in the next week or two of saying, hey, you should talk to this person, or you should talk to this person, or let me connect you to this person. And that's really how I feel like the podcast has grown. And to your point, nowadays with how easy it is to connect, whether that's through the internet or whether that's in person or whether it's on social media, whatever, I think that coaches are so willing to share what they do. There's really no secrets in coaching anymore. And I think that coaches are just super willing to share what they know to try to increase the overall quality of the profession. And so that comes across loud and clear from what you guys are doing. And I think I see the same thing with the podcast. And then the second part of it that I wanted to ask you about is, so when you got done with that first event, did you get some feedback from some of the people who were a part of it? And if you did, what was that feedback? What did people say they liked? What did people say they were looking for? Did anybody give some suggestions of, hey, here's some things that maybe you might want to add, or, hey, I'm looking for this? Just talk to me a little bit about kind of the aftermath of that first event.
Yeah, I think everybody there knew that it was like truly a special event, especially that first one. We always end the conference with like an hour long group discussion, and we open it up and for feedback and questions and comments and suggestions. And, you know, we didn't know that first year, like, okay, is this going to last 5 minutes? That thing lasted like 2 hours. And then even like, you know, we sent an email to everybody, like an email, and it started an email chain that went on for like a year of everyone hitting like reply all and just going back and forth and back and forth. So I think everyone knew it was, super valuable. I think everybody left with new, like really, really good friends in the business. I think everybody left fired up from the content from our speakers. And you know, there was nothing, and there's still 10 years later, which blows my mind, there's nothing else like it. It's an underserved market. There's nothing else for, you know, people trying to get started in the coaching industry. And so like, you know, where else? Of course, there's other clinics, and there's other stuff like that, which are great. You know, there's some really, really good X's and O's clinics, but I think where we're a little different is, you know, we don't necessarily focus on that. We talk about career development. We talk about how do you navigate the coaching profession, and we focus on putting people in a position to, you know, create genuine relationships through our events.
Hey Hoopheads Nation, check out this new offering from Tyler Whitcomb Basketball Coaching Courses. The Steve Wojciechowski Marquette Playbook by Brian Applin is now available. Wojciechowski is in his sixth season as the head men's basketball coach at Marquette University. Visit coachtube.com/users/Tyler Whitcomb to check out this great resource. So at what point in the process of building this thing did you start to look at other ways that you could help coaches besides just the events? And then to go along with that, at what point did you start to realize that this thing could become, for lack of a better term, a viable business? Not necessarily a viable business that you would leave coaching to run yourself as a full-time job, but at what point did you start to realize that this could become something that would be more than one or two one-off events per year and could really be something that could impact coaches year-round as a full-time business?
You know, I think to answer your first question, I think we started adding to it piece by piece and building onto it. You know, we added right away, we added our Final Four event, which was, you know, the kind of the first event held on the Saturday of the Final Four to watch the games. It was kind of like the first watch party that wasn't like an invite only, like you had to know somebody to get the invite or whatever. Or be a part of a certain coaching tree. You know, and I think when we showed up, you know, we showed up the same time, same place the next summer to host our conference, you know, and it went from like 32 people to 110 people. And so we knew that was moving in the right direction. We were excited about that. And every year it's kind of grown and grown. But probably the coolest thing was seeing even after 1 year, seeing the movement of everybody that came to our first event, seeing how they moved up in the industry. And so we knew that like there was a certain camaraderie that we were a part of and building. And, you know, everybody that came kind of took ownership in Rising Coaches, which is what we wanted. And so we just kind of knew that like, as time, first of all, we got super talented people in a room, and good dudes, and you know, people that we thought would do really well in coaching, and we just kind of knew that like as the years went on, these people are just going to continue to advance and advance, and as they advance and eventually become, you know, head coaches themselves or general managers or whatever, like some of them are today, that, you know, we would rise up through the profession with them, and that each year we'd be adding a new, you know, class, so to speak, of new members or new attendees, that hopefully they, you know, we would continue to be able to get them to buy in and take ownership and, you know, have a certain loyalty to the brand. 'Cause it truly is a community, you know, built for and by everyone that's a part of it. The other thing that started happening as early as like the first year is we started fielding calls from different programs, saying like, hey, we need to hire someone. We heard that you guys have a ton of like really talented young coaches. Like, can you give us a recommendation? And so when we started fielding those calls, and now, you know, that first year, I think it was one or two. And now we're fielding calls, you know, two times a week in the off season from people that we've never heard of. And now we're in a position where we can actually help some of those people that have been to the events and that we've gotten a chance to really know really well. That's when we kind of knew like, hey, this is pretty cool, pretty unique, and very, very much needed in the industry, because the coaching profession is nuts. It's hard. There's no like rhyme or reason to it. It's unlike any other industry out there in terms of like how to advance and like, you know, hiring practices. And there's really no rule book, and there's really no one out there helping, unless you're like a high level coach who has an agent, which most of us don't. Or, you know, if you're on like a top 30 under 30 list, or you get invited to one of these exclusive, you know, invite only, you know, top connects or whatever. I was never one of those guys. Most of us, there's a lot more people that aren't on those lists than that are. But we all need help. And so that's kind of when we felt like, hey, we really have a niche here. This is really needed. And, you know, we'd always look at each other and say, hey, if one of us ever got out of coaching and could do this full time, we could really blow it up into something special. But, you know, we were all, you know, really invested in our own coaching careers, and that was the focus. And so the time and resources we put into Rising Coaches was really, really limited. And I think, you know, everyone did a great job keeping the brand alive and growing the brand over the last 10 years, even though none of us, you know, were getting paid or, you know, really had time to do it. And there were years where, you know, I completely said, you know, hey, I can't do it. I'm in the middle of a job change and I got this going on in my life. And Andy Farrell said, I got it. No worries. And then there are other years where Chris Hollander stepped up and said, you know, he loved it and he ran with it. Brandon Rosen, you know, there were so many people. It was really done by committee, and which is just a testament to the community that, you know, we were able to build.
So for you, when does that thought process get you to the point where you say, I want to step away and take this Rising Coaches thing on full time and really see what we can do with it? How long were you thinking about that before you decided to make the jump? And then talk about what that felt like when you no longer had a coaching position, but you were now the CEO of Rising Coaches.
So two kind of completely different things. You know, like I said, we'd always look at each other and say, like, if one of us could do this full time, .. But that didn't necessarily mean that I wanted to be the one to jump out and do it full time. I came to the conclusion, I started going down the path of maybe I should get out of coaching in December of 2018. So, you know, in the middle of the 18-19 season, my last season coaching is when I started coming to that realization. And you know, it just, my wife pointed out to me like, hey, you don't seem very happy. What's going on? And that just kind of started a process of like self-evaluation and reflection. And like, you know, like I said earlier, I've wanted to coach since I was 15 and I've been on this like war path of like, I got to be a coach, you know, as early as I can remember. And so I don't know that I ever really stopped and looked around like, is this really what I want to be doing? I knew like that it was time for me to, you know, experience something different than the situation I was in at SEMO. And so, you know, I just kind of thought, well, hey, maybe I'll get another coaching job. You know, it's time. I've been here 4 years. I've been with Rick 7 years. I love Rick. But it was just, you know, after you coach somewhere and with someone for that amount of time, sometimes you just need to shake it up and get a fresh perspective. And so that was kind of my thought process. And I was like, you know, if I get to the end of the summer and I can't get another coaching job, well, maybe then I'll run Rising Coaches. And, the more, you know, I headed into the off season with that thought process, the more I was just like, maybe I'll just do, like, I kind of think I want to do Rising Coaches. Like, it sounds awesome. And, you know, I think the thing that finally pushed me over the edge, because I made it, I basically went after one job and it happened really quick. And so, like, it was pretty much like April. I did not wait till the end of the summer. I didn't even wait till like middle of the spring. It was probably like the beginning of April. And I was like, I'm just going to do Rising Coaches. And I think the thing that pushed me over the edge is, you know, I think I came to the realization that like, you know, I love, and this was hard, to admit or whatever to myself, but I love being around the players. I love it, but I don't really like live for that like relationship, that like mentorship relationship with the guys. And I freaking run these conferences and I sit there and I listen to the greats and they're all say the same thing essentially is like, you have to be about the players. You have to love them. And I love the players and I did it, you know, like I really do. And if you ask me what I miss about coaching, it's that relationship with the guys. But like the come into my office and let's talk about life. And, you know, like that just wasn't it for me. Like I loved to connect people. Like I loved going and find, and that manifested itself like in recruiting and it manifested itself in a lot of ways in the job. But like, I would love to go identify players that would fit a need for the program and connect them with my boss and then see that connection work and everyone be happy. Like, that's what I really, really got joy out of. And I love hoops and I loved, you know, being in practice, you know, but like when I kind of admitted to myself that that one-on-one relationship with the players isn't what's like ultimately driving me, I was like, I probably shouldn't be doing this. And that's kind of when I was like, okay, I'm going to go all in on Rising Coaches, and I know it could be something special. So let's just give it a shot.
All right. So two things I want to pull out here. One is, first of all, give me an idea of now, once you made that jump, what it's been like for you day to day, maybe in comparison to what your day to day life was like when you were in coaching. So that's the first piece of it. And then the second part of it, you mentioned a little bit earlier that you were starting to realize that no matter where you are, that there are challenges. And you said that you were seeing that there were challenges in business and that everybody has strengths, everybody has things that they're good at. So talk a little bit about what some of the challenges have been and maybe just how it's different day to day from when you were coaching.
Yeah, for sure. So when I first did it, when I first stepped away from coaching and started running Rising Coaches, it was like instant elation and like relief. It was really kind of weird. It was like a honeymoon period. And it went away like that. It for real, like somebody told me, I forget who it was, but I was talking to somebody about it and they're like, yeah, that's going to go away. But they knew exactly what I was talking about. And it does, you know, like three or four months later, that's gone. But the first three, 4 months, it was like, and as soon as I made that decision and, you know, walked away from it, I was like, yes, this is awesome. This is 100% the right thing to do. I'm so happy. And that was great. And that gave me like confidence that I made the right decision. And then, then you got to like figure out how to run a business. And that's hard. I don't know that that's less stressful than coaching. It's funny, a lot of the like advice that I've heard about like how to run your program is the exact same stuff about like how to run a business. So in some ways that was super helpful, and I was kind of sitting on a mountain of like great advice of how to do it, but you still have to figure it out for yourself. So after the honeymoon period ended, and now I'm starting to have to figure out like, you know, like how do I pay bills? But not even that, just like, how do I do this? How do I run a business? I'm sitting here in a home office with a laptop by myself. All my partners are in the middle of their season. Like, what do I do to turn this into, you know, from like a great event that people love and we got a strong brand and everyone feels great about us, into like a profitable year-round business where we're providing value on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, of course, over the last 10 years, we've had so many different ideas of things we can do. And that was the hardest thing, is like, I wanted to do it all.
Right.
And I wanted to do it all right away. And so just the exercise of, you know, figuring out what do I prioritize? What do I spend my time on? I mean, it got dark for a while. Like after that honeymoon period ended, there was about three, 4 months there where I felt like I was spinning my wheels and a lot of self-doubt creeps in. Like, can I do this? I don't know how to do this. I wish I had a boss telling me what to do today, because like I'm wearing 10 different hats and I don't know which hat to wear today. And you know, I feel like I'm doing all these different jobs and none of them really well, instead of being able to do like focus on one thing and be great at it. And so then, you know, I finally was able to kind of snap out of that period and, you know, really start concentrating on a couple of things, like I mentioned earlier, that we wanted to tackle and that we want to be good at and that we want to hang our hat on. And that's our members and our membership, which we created. And that's our, you know, the thing that helped me was focus on our membership, focus on our events. Once you get a handle on that, launch the search firm. And that's kind of the order of things that we've done. And, And that's really helped me. But you really have to be disciplined in subtracting and eliminating all the things that you want to do so that you can focus on a couple things and do it well.
Yeah, I think that's a huge, huge challenge for anybody in any walk of life, but particularly if you're running your own business. And I've always been in my career, I teach in the public schools during the day, but I've always had a side basketball business. And then when I added the podcast, what I always find to be a challenge, and this is something that I think I still struggle with after all the years that I've been doing this, is I find myself working that proverbial working in the business instead of working on the business. And I probably need to take more time to just stop and think and plan and try to figure things out long term, as opposed to, okay, I got to get this episode edited, or I've got to hire these coaches for this camp. I probably need to spend more time on that long term planning. So I can completely relate to what you were going through in terms of trying to figure out how to prioritize your time. So that being said, why don't you go ahead and share for coaches who are out there who maybe have heard of Rising Coaches, or maybe coaches out there who haven't heard of it, talk a little bit about some of the services, some of the things that you provide. What are the core things that if somebody becomes a member or somebody's thinking about joining Rising Coaches, what is it that you can do for them? What are the services that you provide people?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. There's a lot of value adds to the membership. It's $120 a year. And we picked that price point so that it was affordable to everybody. We try to be inclusive. That's always been from day one. One of our missions is we want to be open to any coach at any level, men's basketball, women's basketball, high school to NBA. We've got members from all of those different, walks of life. There's the backlog of our 10 years worth of events, notes, videos, all of the above, which is great. But the biggest thing is the connection piece, in my opinion. The content's great. The exclusive content's great. There'll be some events that members get in at discounted prices. But the ability to connect with other members is truly, to me, our biggest value and what we're all about. It's a relationship business. It just is. I don't like the term networking because it comes off as fake. And we try to be about, creating genuine relationships. So I'll give you an example of how we do it. Obviously we have our membership website and everyone gets a profile and you can connect. You can see who the other members are and hit them up through the site anytime, just like you would, like if you were on Facebook or something. But we have a program called Two Coaches a Month. And if you sign up, it's an optional deal for our members. On the 1st and the 15th of every month, we pair you up with another coach. We give you a topic of discussion. And the expectation is that the two of you guys are going to talk on the phone for a minimum of 10 minutes sometime during the course of that week. So if you do that program for a year, you're going to meet 24 new coaches. That's pretty good.
That's solid.
What happens is people get on the phone and spend 45 minutes on the phone with each other.
I'm sure they do.
And the feedback has been unbelievable from that. So I think that alone, all the content and stuff aside, that alone is super, super valuable.
All right. So let me ask you two things. One, what is it about what you're doing now? What is the part of it that you enjoy the most? And then let's piggyback on that by saying, in your planning, what do you see coming down the pike next? What are some ideas, some thoughts, some things you're kicking around, something that you want to share? Obviously, if it's things that are in development that you're not ready to put out there, great. But just as you look to the future of what Rising Coach is going to be, what do you foresee coming in the future as you look ahead?
What do I enjoy the most? I mentioned it earlier, like in coaching, the thing that I really get excited about is being a connector and like connecting people. So anytime we can facilitate a relationship that ends up being beneficial, whether it's, you know, sometimes it's beneficial professionally, but a lot of times it's just beneficial personally. So anytime we can help connect people and there's mutual benefit, that is really what brings me joy. You know, when we can help someone get a job, that's icing on the cake. And we've been super fortunate to be able to do a lot of both of those things over the years. So that's without question what brings me the most joy, is just being able to help people in the profession and navigate it. Because like I mentioned, it's a hard profession. It's really hard. It's challenging to figure out how to move up in it. And there's so many peaks and valleys, and there's not much support system. So hopefully we can provide that for some people. Plans moving forward. We just launched our search firm, which is kind of a two-prong approach. The first prong is we're doing small college head coaching jobs. You know, we found through our research that there's not many resources available to small colleges in terms of price point, in terms of using a third party to find a head coach. And I've been amazed that like a lot of small colleges hire their coach based off of who applies for the job online, which is mind-boggling to me. Like, that's crazy. But two things to take away from that. Number one, you should go ahead and apply for jobs if you're interested, because you never know. Like, people are getting hired off of that. And number two, like, there's got to be a better way. That's nuts. And the crazy thing is, like, these ADs, a lot of them that I've talked to are valuing their jobs based off of the people that apply. So, you know, I've had ADs tell me, like, oh, our job's just not very good. We can't attract quality candidates. And it's like, no, that's not the case. Like, I know a lot of great coaches who would jump at the opportunity. It's just that nobody sits on their computer and just blindly applies for jobs. Like, nobody knows. That's not how it's supposed to work.
For sure.
So that's the one prong is small college head coaching searches. The other part is, you know, what we've been doing the last 10 years unofficially is helping people fill their staffs. And so that will be marketed towards head coaches. And so if you need, we're still, you know, if you want to post your job, if you get a job open and you want to post it on our job board and you want us to put a tweet out there saying like, hey, this school's looking for this. Hey, we're happy to do that for free. But in terms of like, hey, we want to find an ops guy. We have this much money. This is what we're looking for. Help us find that. We can do that. That's, you know, that's $250 for support staff, $500 for Division I assistants. $250 is small college assistants as well. So for a small price, you know, you can enlist our services to help you, you know, first figure out what it is that you're looking for and then go out and help you find it. Now the interesting thing with that, and I don't know if I'm telling you more than you want to know or not.
No, absolutely. I want to know it all, because I think that people who are out there listening are going to want to know. So yeah, please share.
Well, the interesting thing is like athletics is a little flipped, where the supply and demand is a little skewed. So there's way less jobs than there are people looking for it. So I know a lot of people are like, why would I pay to find a coach when I could literally, you know, post something on whatever and get 200 applicants? Well, that's true, but there's a reason why every other industry in the world invests in hiring and uses, you know, a recruiting service. It's so that you can find that right fit. And I would make the case that like, if you've got a small staff of 6 or 8 or 10 people, you know, if you're bringing one person into that, that person's pretty important. And you know, the phrase that we have on our website and kind of our selling point is like, your culture is only as strong as your weakest link. So yeah, you can just, you know, kind of do it the old fashioned way and put a post online and see who applies and pick and choose out of that. Or, you know, you can hire us, who has an unbelievable pulse on, you know, who's out there in the talent pool and, you know, who would be a great fit. And we'll help make sure that we find you that and find you a pool of, you know, 5 people that would be really good and let you pick from there. So that's the search firm, and we're super excited about that. The other thing that we're going to do is we're going to open up our member site. We're going to have a free membership that we launch right around the Final Four. So that like ability to have a profile page and connect with other coaches and essentially just have like an online database of coaches out there, that's going to be free. Now, the two coaches a month program where we're linking you up with other coaches, the exclusive content, you know, a lot of the member benefits, those are still going to be for the premium members only. But we are going to open up that, you know, that community site to everybody.
That's very cool. I think to be able to have one, that'll get people onto the platform to see what you guys are all about. And then two, to be able to have these more premium services that you can provide to coaches that want those. To me, that seems like a great model. I think you guys are really onto something. As we've talked about throughout the entire podcast, there's a tremendous need out there to help coaches to be able to navigate the coaching profession and sort of the road and the way that you have to go in order to get to where you want to go in the coaching profession. We all know it's very, very difficult. It's challenging, and being able to get connected to the right people and then connect to the right job is critically important. One thing I took away from as you were talking about how important it is to make sure that a coach fits with a staff, I kept coming back to in my head. I kept thinking about how important when we think of winning teams in any sport, you hear so often the term team chemistry, or now it's probably more accurately described as culture, but you think about the fact that when everybody fits together and people get along and it's a staff that has a lot of camaraderie, I'm sure, and I'm sure you can attest to this, that those staffs tend to be a happier, and I'm sure that a happier staff in terms of those interpersonal relationships, that ends up rubbing off on the success that the team has both on the scoreboard in terms of the relationships that everybody associated with the program has. And so to me, these services are just tremendously valuable that you're putting out there, Adam, with Rising Coaches. And I'd like to give you a chance here. We're coming up on an hour and a half. I want to give you an opportunity to share all the ways that people can find out more about what you're doing. Please tell them a little bit about your podcast, your social media, your website. Give them all the contact information, how they can reach out to you. And then if there's anything that we didn't touch on that you want to share before we get out, please go ahead and do that. And then I'll jump back in and wrap up the episode.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Mike. And again, thank you so much for the opportunity. I really enjoyed hanging out with you over the phone here tonight and getting a chance to talk hoops. It's always fun for me to relive my glory days.
Absolutely. So it's been a pleasure. I appreciate that. Absolutely.
But yeah, the website is risingcoaches.com. You can find everything on there. If you're interested in the membership, if you're just interested in checking out our content, we have a free blog on there as well. You can also find out about our upcoming events, which we are about to update that page for all of our 2020 events here in probably the next 7 to 10 days. So excited about that. Social media, we're at Rising Coaches on pretty much everything. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, you name it. We're on there. So you can find us there. And then, yeah, you mentioned also, and I appreciate it again, our podcast, the Rising Coaches podcast, which has been a lot of fun. And we've been fortunate to get a lot of people come on and tell their story and talk about, you know, how they've navigated the profession, how they've gotten to where they're at and the lessons they've learned along the way. So it's been a lot of fun. And then anyone who wants to reach out, please feel free to reach out to me directly, adam@risingcoaches.com, if you have questions or want to learn more.
Awesome. Adam, can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us tonight. It's been a pleasure getting to know you, getting to learn more about all the great things you're doing with Rising Coaches. I know there's been a ton of valuable information that you've shared in addition to us learning more about your basketball journey. I think there's been a lot of great takeaways for coaches. Hopefully, members of our audience who are out there listening, please go and check out risingcoaches.com. Check out what Adam's doing. I think it's going to be something that you're not going to regret going and getting involved and helping yourself in the coaching profession. So Adam, once again, thanks for joining us tonight. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Registration is now open at headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps.
We'll be hosting camps for boys and girls in grades 1 through 6 throughout the greater Cleveland area. Get registered today and make sure you hit the courts with us this summer.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.